Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today I'm dedicating virtually the whole show to the second half of my interview with Keith Fitzgerald, State Representative of District 69 in Sarasota, a virtual mini course in political science. So hang on, here come the show. Today I'm going to spend almost the entire show playing the second half of my interview with Keith Fitzgerald. I played the first, actually it's probably the first third of it in last week's show. And if you were listening, I'm fairly sure you came back for the second two-thirds, because Keith is absolutely fascinating. And what he has to say about what it means to be a good politician, what politics really is supposed to be, is invaluable. In this show, Keith demonstrates something that he talks about, but you can see he actually winds up demonstrating it. Keith is talking on and off through this interview about inclusion, about not being so rigidly attached to your point of view that you cannot see the other side, about the way, the importance of being able to be larger than yourself, not to be dogmatic or ideological, to hold to your position, not to lose yourself, to have your moral compass, but not to be so rigidly attached to it that you can get nothing done, that all you ever have are adversarial interactions. And towards the end of this interview, Keith demonstrates this, and I'm embarrassed to say that I give him the opportunity to do it. He's talking about development in Sarasota County and how, because so many of us, including me, and that's what I say, you know, you're talking to one of those people right now, are so adamantly against development in Sarasota that we make it impossible for developers to do what would be good for us, and we force them to do exactly what we don't want them to do. And that if we were able to listen to one another, if we were able to be larger than ourselves, we could both get what we want. Sarasota could get the kind of development it needs, and developers could get their work. And Keith demonstrates this with me. He shows me how I'm not doing it and how it can be done. And in that exercise, which was completely unplanned, of course, in that experience, he demonstrates the politician that he is and what it means to be a good politician. What a really good politician. It's so funny because the name itself, the word itself, has come to be so, to have such a bad reputation, to be so pejorative. Politician, it means something like, oh, I'm embarrassed to say this, like used car salesman. Also has become, I'm sure there are wonderful used car salesmen out there, and I'm sorry if I have offended anybody. But Keith demonstrates that politics, to be a politician, is a noble and worthy occupation if you do it in a noble and worthy way. And in this interview, he demonstrates it without trying, without, I think, even intending to, simply because it is who he is. And because he is that, then it makes it possible for others to be that. So this interview, it seems to me, is really important if it demonstrates what we really want in the people who represent us, what we really want to support, to encourage, to have. We don't want ideologues. We don't want people like me who take a side and are so attached to it that they lose the capacity to get what is in the greater good, even for themselves. Okay, I think I've beaten this into the ground. Hopefully you still want to hear this interview. Also, last week I was talking about the trick of camouflage that our unconscious uses to distract us from changes that we might not yet be ready to make. And at the end, I gave you an opportunity to do a little guided imagery to see if you could discover some camouflage problems that you might be experiencing that might be offered to you by your unconscious as a way of protecting you. I'm not going to have time in this show to continue the conversation about the unconscious and camouflage, but next week I will pick up with another camouflage problem, and I will continue that into November. But having said all that about the interview, I think what I'm going to do now is just play the second half of the interview. And so here again, I am so happy to be airing Keith Fitzgerald.
Back to this whole theme of citizenship and civic engagement. The liberal and liberal arts refers to the arts necessary for free people to govern themselves.
Oh my.
That's what the liberal and liberal arts means. The root being liberal, meaning liberty, free. You're supposed to go to a liberal arts education. In the 19th century, this was the notion.
That you become a citizen.
You would become a citizen. So there was this formal introduction to the classics. You can sort of see why I start the conversation talking about the Greeks, because within our culture, I'm not saying it's the only right way to look at it, but
that's where
it comes to us, and it has lots of sources. Some of it's biblical and comes from ancient Jews. A lot of it is Greek. Some of it is Roman, so on and so forth. When we formed the Constitution, in the Enlightenment, the big project was to find these resources everywhere you could. So Benjamin Franklin studied the Constitution of some of the Native Americans, looking for how people have figured out how to get this stuff right. Okay, so, you know, this used to be a big project. You know, how do you learn this and get it right? And you went to college with the notion of becoming one of the elite people. It was an elitist system, but people who had these appropriate skills. The model of the 19th century typically is you separated yourself off from society, which is why a lot of colleges and universities are out in the countryside. You know, you remove yourself from society and you immerse yourself in these ideas. I think that is a totally inappropriate model for where we are now, since we've lost the connection with society. As we educate people, we really need them engaged in actual communities, because community is disrupted, and that's at the heart of the problem here. But in the 20th century, now there were a lot of things objectionable about that model. We should be really clear about that. Certainly it was segregated by sex. Women's colleges taught domestic skills because it was assumed women would stay there. That was undermined pretty quickly because the women's colleges in the late 19th century became bastions for what was called at the time Republican motherhood. And Republican being, again, the notion of Republican being a rich form of citizenship where people took responsibility. So the idea was they would be teaching women these skills of domesticity, which would help them produce the next generation of male heirs. But you know, they set up these little communities with that purpose, and you know, they just went off on their own way.
Right.
And that's where feminism
came
in the first wave was born.
Right. They made a mistake.
They made a mistake. When you set up free society of people based on freedom and tell them to talk, they do.
And they don't necessarily... Yeah, right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The conversation goes where it's going to go. That's how democracy works. So, and that's where the first wave of feminism came from. So, you know, we shouldn't romanticize that model. It was elitist, it was sexist, class-based, so on and so forth. But there was something really good in that idea.
Well, it did have the intention of creating
responsible
people who could,
citizens. Right. Exactly. And so in the 20th century, we sort of redesigned higher education as a superannuated professional school.
Right.
Even the undergraduate professions. My own profession started off as being called the departments of government and then became departments of political science. The idea was you were taking this out of the realm of action and putting it into the realm of theory and science. And so political science and sociology and so forth transformed into professions that looked like engineering and natural sciences. There were some good things in that. It promoted a lot of rigorous thinking about how society works, and that's a good thing. But, again, the baby thrown out with the bathwater is that you really didn't take as part of your higher education the inculcation of these skills.
And you had all this information. What were you going to do with it?
Well, that is right. If you go back to look at even urban planning in the late 19th century, there's a lot of awareness that part of what you needed to plan in were public spaces so that there would be occurrences for people to interact as citizens. And if you think about how we do planning now, we tend to have functional zoning, so we separate things off by function. And one of the functions that tends to be left aside is the public sphere. And really, we've sort of designed it out because the planning profession went along the way of a lot of these other things. Architects started building more monuments than public
spaces.
Yeah. That was lost in a lot of respects. And again, you start to see the turn. Now planners are very much aware of this, and the new urbanist movement and so forth really thinks a lot about this, and they're working to regenerate public spaces and spaces where people come and assemble, and that's a good thing. So we start to see it changing.
I remember in the late 60s and the early 70s, there was this big push for community, self-contained, no cars, spaces that really were designed for human beings to live in. What happened to that movement?
Well, it evolved. I mean, it's
itself out.
No, it's gotten better. I mean, so the impulse was there. Those were the seeds of ideas that are now bearing some fruit, and they made a lot of mistakes along the way. Because one of the things that I think people have figured out is that the old urban form that the automobile destroyed worked pretty well.
Yeah.
Okay, and so
for human beings
and. There were a lot of things that undid it in addition to the automobile, but the automobile certainly plays a central role. The old urban form, and this is a nice thing about Sarasota, the old urban form did not segregate people off by class so much. So if the banker actually lives three blocks away from the working class kids, the banker has a stake in the community, and that sort of shapes the moral universe.
Well, he knows the working class kids.
Yeah, and he sees them on the street.
That's right, and he has a sympathy for them.
And a commitment. I mean,
right.
They share
yeah.
the same space.
Right.
He wants them to...
To be all right.
To be all right.
Exactly.
And the shop owners would see the kids playing in the street and would watch out for them.
Right.
And, you know, the Hillary notion that parenting was done at a village level was just dead right on.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean,
it does take a village.
Absolutely.
And I'm just thinking now about growing up in a suburb of New York, and, I mean, really, you didn't do anything on the street because somebody told your mother, you know.
Right.
You know, and if you couldn't get in the house, you went to somebody, the next-door neighbor or somebody. And the,
right.
You know, I mean, we were a community that, you know, and that was New York City, for God's sake, you know.
Yeah, and now that sort of the suburban form that's taken root segregates people. They segregate things functionally, so all the homes are over here. Mm-hmm. The commerce is over there, so there isn't a street anymore.
Yeah,
the street is just a way to drive from one place to another.
Right.
You don't
right.
see kids playing out on the street. And, you know, just as a parent, I grew up in the suburbs, but I think the attitudes were still there. You would see people out on the streets. If I let my kids do what my mother let me do, the people from Children and Family Services would be taking them away, right?
Yeah, right.
Because you would open up the door
right.
in the morning and say,
see ya.
See ya. And you were off.
Right.
And there was a general sense that you were
you'd be all right.
pretty safe.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, when the very first time I came to Sarasota, I said, oh my God, there's a sense of community here. And I was living in L.A. where it doesn't exist. And I mean, it was visceral for me that I knew it and I could tell it and I missed it.
There is actually some research about what size community is a good one to encourage civic engagement in the political sphere.
Well, it got me into the political sphere.
Well, and the magic number is around 50,000. And here's the idea. And this is borne out with empirical research to show that this is, it's not just a theory. It sort of works out this way. What you want is enough politics so that it's interesting for people to engage. But not so much that it gets overwhelmed by big organizations, big money, and so forth. Sarasota is a nice size. That
How
way.
Big are we?
The city itself is about 55,000,
yeah.
so it's right the right size.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're comprised, obviously, of lots of small cities. Venice is a similar size. Northport's a similar size. Same situation a little bit in Manatee. And so then the county is sort of a collection of these smaller communities that really feel like communities.
Right.
And it really, I think it's really true, because that's how I left the classroom, got more involved in real world politics, is partly somebody asked me to serve on the Charter Review Commission for the city. And it was interesting enough that, you know, it fulfilled my need to be engaged in the community and be a good citizen. It wasn't, you know, so trivial that it just makes your brain go dead. Well, you know, with some small town politics, it's really boring.
I believe you.
So, well, you know, I mean, how exciting can it be if you're just talking about where to put the sewer cap or something like that? But, okay, this place, we dealt with some interesting issues, and people from different walks. So it was sort of interesting kind of thing. But it wasn't so overwhelming that you felt like you had to, you know, sell your soul or make it a profession to get
give up your life.
Right.
Right.
And that's really what you want. And believe it or not, these things actually do come up when I'm in the legislature, because we deal with issues like growth management. Sarasota is a pretty nice place in these respects, and I think a good model. You could also find L.A.-like places in Florida as well, where it's sort of crazy.
So are you saying I don't have to worry about Sarasota turning into L.A.?
I don't think you have to worry about Sarasota moving into L.A., but here's part of the thing. It's because it's the right size that citizens have a stake, can be engaged, and so they're very much part of the conversation about how growth can go. And you see that. It hasn't always been a very easy conversation, because economically we're built on development. And a lot of people's jobs are in development, and there's nothing inherently bad about that. On the other hand, there are a lot of people who are very much concerned that either too much or the wrong kind of development could undermine the best things about the community.
Well, you're sitting across the table from one of those.
Well, so that makes for real tension and a politics that's important to engage in. And I think it's a political question where there are really interesting compromises. It's not just one side against the other.
Well, we're back to that again.
Well, it's true. I mean, there, if you get these people talking, you find out that if people are willing to let go of some of their antipathies and actually think about what it is that they share, they can come up with some interesting things. And we're actually doing that here. It's good. But you see the problem with, so this community is a good scale community to be confronting these issues. It hasn't, as I say, not everybody's happy with the outcome at any given time. But the very fact that we have these conversations and people are involved, that's a good thing. But statewide, there's a movement called Hometown Democracy, which from the developer standpoint, and I, people may not be happy to hear me say this, but I think they're absolutely right, is not so much about democracy, but just sort of monkey wrenching the entire process of thinking about how development will go. I think it's a terrible idea.
I don't know what it is.
Well, what Hometown Democracy says is that they want to pass a constitutional amendment that says that every community in Florida, if it wants to alter its comprehensive plan, which is a document every community is required to file with the state, has to put that amendment to their comprehensive plan up to a vote. Well, this would mean we would be continually having referenda on every major development in every community. So there'd be frequent elections. And this is born out of the frustration.
Yeah, people are mad.
People are furious. They're
right.
Angry, and they understand that this is really just a way of stopping development.
Well, what's interesting to me about this is that, you know, I'm on that side of the table, and I'm thinking if people in development were more sympathetic and understood how pissed everybody is, then things like this wouldn't happen to happen.
But and see, here's the irony. Okay.
Either side could be the one.
Here's the irony.
Yeah.
What we need is good politics.
Yes,
right?
I understand.
If you had the right kind of communities, these two competing sides
could figure it out. Yeah, I got it.
Right?
Got it. Yeah.
Which ironically requires that you have the right size community and right characteristics, which is not what we're doing with the development we're getting.
Right.
But, you know, I'm also very sympathetic to developers because these are guys who are, you know, they're mainly guys, people who are trying to make a living and they're employing people and this is the way we've done it. There's nothing fundamentally immoral about what we're doing, you know. So there are legitimate interests they have, a legitimate interest the people on the other. But the response is not to say, let's figure out how we can fight this out, find the common ground, get to where. No, the response is, let's just blow up the whole thing.
Well, you know, it's so interesting, Keith, because I'm thinking. You know, I'm listening to you, and I believe everything you're saying, and my gut is saying they don't care about the communities they're developing in. They build in these communities, and then they leave. They don't care what they've done to the quality of life. That's that position, you know?
No, I understand why you think that. On the other hand, a lot of them do care, and a lot of them do stay, and a lot of them could be persuaded that they could do things a different way. But you've got to sit down and have that conversation.
I absolutely see it.
How do we get there? What is it, you know, so one of the things that I've tried to do, and I'm a fairly smart person, I don't know anything about development. I don't know what their margins are as businessmen and so forth. So I sit down and I talk to them and I listen to them and I try to figure out, what does it take to be a developer in a place like Sarasota or in a community that's not quite as good as Sarasota? How do you stay alive and how do you give people jobs and what do you have to do?
Without doing this other thing.
And then the question is there something you can do in the policy environment that enables them to make the living that they want to make while building the kind of communities we want them to build? So let me give you a simple example. I'll use Sarasota again. A lot of people would like to freeze downtown Sarasota in amber. Right? Let's keep it just exactly the way it is.
Right.
Okay. Well, so first of all, at the imaginative level, it's sort of a romantic notion because,
right,
in fact, the Sarasota you're trying to preserve
isn't even the one that was here when I got here.
Exactly. It never existed.
Right.
It was sort of a figment of your imagination. But not only that, but just a fundamental feature of capitalism is that you need...
Yours, not mine.
Yeah,
right?
You need to have reinvestment, mm-hmm. right? Capital stock declines.
What does that mean?
If you've got...
Buildings.
Buildings.
Yeah, I got it.
Stores.
Okay. Yeah, right.
If you're not in replacing and improving it, it dilapidates, okay? If we don't reinvest in downtown Sarasota continually, it's going to turn into a dump.
Right.
Okay.
The amber will crack.
It's just not going to be a very desirable. When I moved here, they had used shoe store shops on Main Street.
I know. I remember.
Not very exciting.
Yeah, no.
Okay. It was not a place you really wanted to go. Okay. So that's just a fundamental thing. We cannot freeze that in amber. Well, here's the irony. A lot of the anti-growth people on your side, and I think probably where I started from, mm-hmm. make the rules for development so hard, thinking we're going to stop those developers,
right.
that they can't reinvest. They can't reinvest in areas that are already developed. They then can go
have
out.
Have to go out. Oh, God.
To where the land is cheap and
right.
the regulations are loose.
Right.
And they can do whatever they want.
Right.
You see, so...
I do.
So, ironically, you know, we think we're trying to improve the quality of our great community by stopping those wicked developers, and what we do is set up the incentives
for them
that make them go out and do what we don't want them to do and prevent them from doing what we do want them to do,
right.
which is redevelop and reinvest in the urban core. So, you're only going to get to that realization if you're willing to sit down
and talk.
Figure out
right.
what's going on here, where are our common interests, how can we get there. Boy, he's really persistent. Okay.
Do you want me to stop this?
Oh, I know what's going on. I was hitting the wrong button.
I should probably... I don't know how much time I have on this thing. What time is it?
4:10.
Oh, good. I'm okay.
Okay. I have a little bit. I was answering the phone, and then he probably heard me talking, and I kept, I'll call him back.
That's very funny.
Yeah. Anyway, so, and that's the value, you know, this is sort of circles back around in the conversation. That is the value of
citizen participation.
Healthy politics, citizen participation, you can find that common ground. I think on this issue, it's there. You know, we can, basically you go to the, that's the message now.
Oh, okay.
You go to the developers and say, we're going to listen to you. You know, now, we might ask you to change a little bit what you're doing because you're used to going out where you don't have to deal with traffic concurrency is one of these barriers I'm talking about, to where you can just build what you want to build. But we're going to make it easier for you by relaxing some of these regulatory burdens we put on you. Well, you say the business guy, less regulation...
Oh,
they think
you're
a prince.
Right, you have a happy...
But on the other hand, you might actually get, you know, as somebody who doesn't like our development patterns, get what you want.
Right.
So, really at the heart of the problem, I think, is politics and the fact not too much politics, but actually too little.
Yes.
We don't value it. We don't teach people how to do it well. We don't pay attention to the institutions. And consequently, people are continually upset with and disappointed in politics. They suspect everybody. It becomes disreputable. It's hard to attract good people into it.
Well,
and the quality of it goes down.
Well, and not only that, but people get isolated.
Right.
And then alienated.
Right. And that, you know, again, this example, this idea of if I sat you down with some of our friends in the development community, that turns out they're not all monsters.
No, I'm sure that's true.
Well, so, I mean, but this is my point, is that when they're over there,
right,
they're the bad guys.
It's us and them.
I absolutely guarantee you that most of the conversation, if you were one of them, would be about those crazy anti-development environmentalists who just hate business and don't understand us and, you know, might even be, you know, socialists or something bad. And it
socialists like
that. Right.
Yeah.
Well, but that's where they're coming from, and it's because that you, when you are talking to people at a distance through really very murky media, you don't have a very good conversation. You get people in the room and you start saying, we've got a practical problem here. Is there a way to work our way out of it? It's not going to be a happy conversation at every point along the way.
So I'm sitting here wondering, this is just natural for you, right? This is like duck in water.
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah, because this is, you couldn't keep this up if it weren't a natural thing. This would be too hard to continue to walk that line, to see that line, to, I'm making gestures because I can't think of the words.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've been thinking about this stuff my whole life, and it pulls together a lot of different interests, everything from philosophy to really practical politics, which I enjoy doing.
No.
So, well, you know, but there are a lot of people who would be great or much better than me as philosophers and much better than me, say, as practical politicians, but there aren't too many people who do
I think that's exactly right, and I think...
But here's the thing, it is a little bit, when it becomes a professional pursuit, it can be oppressive, because I do have other interests in life, you know what I'm saying?
Well, I'm listening to you and I'm thinking, I would be in tilt to have to manage this, hold this, juggle this all the time.
Well, but don't you think that if you were talking to a mathematician and they were talking about how they're working through various different formulas and so forth, I mean, when I listen to mathematicians, I just think, just listening to this is exhausting.
Well, and people say that to me about being a therapist.
Right.
They say, oh my God, I couldn't do that. But that's the point I'm making, is that it's a natural kind of thing for you.
Well, but it's also a skill. I mean, I would compare it to the therapist, mathematician, a musician, it's easier to you and more fun because you get good at it,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you know, anything you understand and you appreciate, you want to excel at doing, and so you're drawn to it.
And the better you get at it, the more success you have at it,
and
those things are really great.
You can be successful, and that's good, and... you know, it's one fun thing about politics is that it can call on all your human capacities.
Yeah.
Because there's an art to it, okay? When you get up and give an extemporaneous speech in a debate, there's an art to that. It's fun.
Did you know before?
What? About
the art?
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, I think I gave the first... public speech I remember giving was in the sixth grade.
Okay. Oh, yeah, you've been training for this a long time.
I've always liked giving speeches. Most people get all nervous.
No, you're right.
This is something I really enjoy.
But again, I'm just going to keep repeating this. It's a natural thing for you.
Yeah, but, again, I would say it's just like, when people would say to Michael Jordan, it's natural, you always sort of wondered if there wasn't a sort of, if he had this special talent. Of course he had special talent, but I always wondered when people would say that about him if there wasn't possibly a racist undertone, that it couldn't also be a huge amount of self-discipline that allowed him to take that talent and perfect it.
So do you think that this is sexist?
No. I'm just saying that when people look like they're a natural at something, it's often because... they may have some skills, and that encourages them to try to excel at it, and so they become better at it.
Yeah, it's right? Interesting. I think that, although I've not thought about this before, I think I believe in natural talent, that somebody who didn't have a natural talent could have worked as hard as Michael Jordan and never done.
Yeah, absolutely. For example, me.
Yeah, you.
Exactly. I can't jump. that's a real barrier to my, and I'm 5'7", so I'm probably not going to be in the NBA, okay? So I couldn't be Michael Jordan. It's not just, but we don't want to denigrate, on the other hand, that there was character involved.
And I didn't mean to suggest that there wasn't, or with you either.
Well, and so, but this is, this goes back to this theme, that if we want better politicians, part of what we have to do is start to understand that there are real skills involved in it, that they have to be inculcated, And they have to be perfected, and they have to be respected. I'm not saying you have to respect all politicians. Not all politicians are respectable. But you do have to respect. So again, you know, well, you see this with this response with Obama, which I find so fascinating. They find out the guy's a politician, and they say, I'm so disappointed.
Right.
No. Right? We should say, isn't this great?
Isn't this terrific?
You know, this guy has this huge capacity to move people with words, which is, again, the art of it. He's a performer
of the first magnitude.
And at the same time, he can get in the back room and make the deal happen.
Right.
Great!
So do you think we should be teaching it?
Absolutely.
I mean, literally teaching it.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it's like a lot of things that a lot of sort of complex tasks are can best be taught indirectly sometimes, but yeah.
Michael couldn't have learned that indirectly.
No, the analogy breaks down with basketball, but maybe a lot of sports.
Well, but you know...
Although if you went to the basketball practice, they would do a lot of drills, right?
Yeah, right.
You know, they do dribbling drills, they do defensive drills, they run up and down the basketball court backwards to work on their footwork. Okay, that's what I mean, is that you don't necessarily push people into actual politics when they're in the sixth grade, but maybe you do push some of them in front of the Rotary Club and tell them, give a speech. I still remember the speech I gave at the Rotary Club when I was in the sixth grade. That was my problem. Okay.
Well, I'm thinking a number of things. You could have... You know, we used to have class president and that stuff. You could have kids actually learning to lobby, to speak, to at an early age. But I'm kind of still stuck on this natural thing. And I'm thinking in kindergarten or the first or second grade, they called my mother in and they said to her, we can't keep Lynn in her seat. She's at everybody's seat learning their business. See, I had a natural interest in...
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean?
Oh, sure. And there's definitely something to that.
I don't think that... I mean, I had to learn stuff. I don't think that demeans the ability of the... You know.
No, yeah. And I'm not... I don't disagree with that at all. When I was... I remember John F. Kennedy's funeral. Mm. Okay? And what I remember specifically, I actually remember that week very well. So I mean, part of this, maybe there's a Freudian aspect to it. My mother loved John F. Kennedy. Mm-hmm. He's Irish Catholic, mm-hmm. and so forth. And that was clearly obvious to me. Okay, so there's sort of an approval-seeking aspect to this. Mm-hmm. Which, yeah, that's good.
Good.
But I remember at the funeral, one of the specific things is that Roy Wilkins was on. You remember?
I do.
Okay. And I asked my mother who this guy was, because I was fascinated with this whole event, and partly horrified because all the adults were breaking down.
Right.
And, you know, as a kid, this was seven.
Oh, my.
And, you know, so to see the entire adult world just fractured was a very scary thing. Roy Wilkins was on. He was talking. I asked my mother who he was, and she said, you know, he's the president of whatever it was, whatever. And I said, well, what is that? And she said, well, that's an organization. I think in those days we still called them colored people. That was the polite term. And I remember asking her why those people had their own president. And she tried to explain it to me, I was not satisfied. I could not figure out why you would have some people have, and I said, was this a different president? Was President Kennedy not their president? Well, yes, he was. I needed to understand what was going on there, and it bugged me, and I remember then paying close attention to the civil rights movement, partly just because I had this puzzle in my head about what was going on with this. Mm-hmm. Why did these people need a different president? And things like that. When I was, I remember when I was my kids' age, and I don't think they are going in this direction. When I was 8 years old, I remember having the Electoral College map drawn out on a poster board and watching the results come in from the Kennedy or the Johnson-Goldwater election and then coloring in the states. So, yeah, there was something going on.
No.
Not many 8-year-olds were doing that. So
no.
There was something going on. But, you know, the other side of that, though, and it's back to the other thing about the skill stuff, is that probably an interest in giving speeches, and the performance aspect was tied into that, and maybe even was partly the sort of approval-seeking behavior, which is a healthy thing in a kid. But bringing in the philosophical side of it, that was a totally separate thing.
That's an amazing diversion. That's the thing. That's what's so interesting about you, is that for me anyway.
Maybe not for you,
but that somebody with that interest, you might have expected them to take a less theoretical road.
Yeah, that's probably true. And I mean, I can sort of explain it at a level that makes sense to me, but maybe not to a biographer or somebody on the outside.
Are you going to write?
It's an ironic question because I have so little time for that right now. I think that I could, I think it would be very, very boring for me to write a strictly academic book about what I'm engaged in because most of the things that I observe that are related to my academic training are known and trivial and obvious. So I think the more interesting thing for me to write about would be to sort of go on these citizenship themes, and which would be, a certain, not a typical kind of academic thing, but I don't think something that most practitioners could be able to do, because I can translate between the two communities to the people who are interested in the political philosophy of citizenship. I can say, I have really observed a few things and put things together and made some links with at a policy level in the practical world. And, on the other hand, there is something very rich about the way people have been thinking about this really for centuries for the everyday world, because when you're trying to do this stuff, you really don't have a whole lot of time to think about it. So you'll find people who can be very good at it. And here's a crucial thing. Why are we so disappointed with our politicians? There are a lot of people who are very skilled at aspects of it, right? The strategic aspect, the communication, the persuasion. Lots of people are very good at that. It's unusual to find people who are really good at the policy and the politics. And that's a little disappointing, because you'd like to see those things wedded more commonly than
what did you think of Bill?
Bill
Clinton.
I would say that describes his genius.
Yeah, right.
Right?
I think so too.
I think Ronald Reagan was brilliant at the politics of it. I don't think he paid enough attention to policy, because it just wasn't his thing.
Right.
A lot of people who dislike what he did underestimate the vastness of his skill in the political realm, the ability to move people, to inspire people. And if you were inspired, you go, what's with that?
Right.
What is this guy?
Right.
But he was good at it, okay? Clinton actually could do that and bring
the policy to it.
But there's a third aspect to it beyond the policy and the politics, and that's the sort of the character dimension, where you would like these people to be trying to think of really what the founding fathers talked about, which is what they called republican virtues, which is the applied capacity to subordinate your own interests
to the greater good. Yeah.
And that's a matter of character. There's also a lot of skill, so you have to be good at recognizing it. There's a reason why they're really trying to get me. There's a reason why George Washington, who was not the great intellectual of the age, was the most revered figure, because time and time and time again, he was the guy who could set aside his own interest for what was good for the country. And he did it in really remarkable ways. He was stiff. He was not formally educated. He wasn't as eloquent as some of them were. He wasn't as bright as some of them were. I mean, Adams and Jefferson and Hamilton were all a lot smarter than he was. But time and time and time again, he stepped up and could do what was good for the country and subordinate his interests. Now, the irony is, they had this, at the time, a lot of this was based on this I think sort of almost fanciful reading of the Roman Empire and the Greek Republics, but it doesn't matter because it was a regulative. The regulative principles they drew from their reading of that may not have been historically accurate, but really functional. George Washington got his reward, right? Because the reward of a virtuous citizen is the regard
of the citizenry.
Of the citizenry. Mm-hmm. And nobody was as well regarded.
Really? I didn't know that.
Oh, George Washington was head and shoulders above. Now, that doesn't mean they didn't have knocked down, dirty, drag out. George Washington was subject to rumor campaigns that makes the Obama stuff look mild. Absolutely. Thomas Paine accused him of being a spy for the British throughout the Revolutionary
God.
War. While he was president, he accused him of being a spy for the British during the Revolutionary War. We had the same kind of dirty politics in those days as we have now. But the point is, to that generation, this guy was revered like you can't believe. And that was it. I mean, so he got his reward. And I think that, you know, one of the things that a well-ordered society does is set the reward structure so that people who do behave virtuously
get
the reward.
Right.
You know, there's a sort of mistake we make that somehow everybody is being selfish all the time because people who try to be good and get recognized for it are just sort of seeking another good. Some goods are better to seek than others. And
I love that line.
Well, you know, so if you have a kind of reward structure that encourages people to see it as very rewarding to be recognized for doing well by the rest of the society, you're doing okay, right?
Yeah.
It works for everybody.
It works for everybody.
And that's what they had going. Now, again, lots of bad things about the social order that we have to recognize. It was that kind of excellence, the Greek word is arete, that the preeminent citizen could attain was a good only available to a small slice of the society.
Yeah.
So there we've made improvements. And one of the things I think, I tell students this, that in the United States we've expanded the universe of citizenry to be almost all-inclusive, but we've denigrated the value and importance of citizenship to the point where it's now not such a cherished thing.
No, I would go so far as to say that we seem to reward stuff that isn't necessarily good. I mean, we seem to think that, you know, if you cheat and you do well, then those rewards that you got, you deserve them, and that's a, you know, we admire you for it somehow.
Yeah, exactly. And it's sort of an excessive form of individual.
Yeah, it's gone wild.
Yeah, individualism gone wild. We
right.
can make a video. It probably wouldn't sell. But anyway, yeah, exactly. And these guys lived in this universe where to get the rewards you had to be... Well, or a simple concept is that responsibilities and duties always balanced rights and privileges. And we've sort of...
And that you could honor that somehow, that was a virtue.
That was a virtue.
Right.
Somebody,
now you remember the movie with Michael Douglas, you know, Greed is Good,
yeah.
Wall Street, you know.
Yeah. And that's because we've sort of narrowed down citizenship to rights, and rights include, you know, so for example, this generation of these founding fathers certainly thought that people had liberties, but they regarded people who used those liberties for self-indulgence as libertines.
Yes.
They were licentious, all the same kind of word, roots
right,
in the
right,
words.
Right.
And that was the worst thing you could be.
Yes.
You know, to actually be in the class of people who could enjoy citizenship and to use it for just, you know, self-indulgence. Boy, what a low life. Now, we celebrate that. You know, we have whole web pages. And,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. For that.
Greed is good.
Yeah, and just blatant self-indulgence. And, you know, and I'm not a prude by any means. That's not my point at all. It's just that we just focus on the wrong stuff. You know, I don't really, you know, I think it's sort of fascinating the way we do with celebrities, you know, where you get these kids and you make them famous before they've grown up, and then everybody turns on them. And
yeah, right, what they're doing with money, what's her name?
Trashes them when they misbehave.
Right, or when they do what they see everybody else doing. I mean, you know...
I got to stop and make a phone call here.
It's all right, I do too.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
And with that, we both went back to our busy lives. I have to say I'm grateful to Keith for all the time that he gave me. And I know that I only scratched the surface of what Keith has to say, what he knows, and what he has to offer about what it means to be a politician, what it means to be a citizen, participating in your democracy, taking responsibility for what happens in your world. And although I'm not interested in having a political program, I am interested in bringing to the program interesting, worthwhile people who have something really important to say. As you know, if you've been listening, this series is about art. I've called it Anatomy of an Artist series. And originally when I wanted to interview Keith, I thought this would be a departure. But as you also know, if you've heard the interview, Keith is clear that he thinks of politics, being a politician, as an art form, something that one has to work at, a skill one needs to develop. And that, as a point of view, is so interesting to me. And I believe it is not the common conventional wisdom. So, fortunately for me, this is not a diversion or a distraction from my purpose, as Keith is an artist. So, I'm going to play a song from my CD. I haven't said in a long time that the song that opens the show and the song that closes the show are both from my CD called I Won't Go With a Whimper, which you can find if you go up on my website, thelinshow.com, and you can click on the little icon for the CD if you want, and it'll take you to CD Baby where you can listen to pieces of it. But I'm going to play a song today which is kind of about absurdity. And I'm playing it because it seems so appropriate to what's going on in our world. Truly, we are living in the theater of the absurd. So the song is called Which Way Is Out?
I went to see the doctor. He laid me on his couch. And as I talked of dreams, he put my money in his pouch. Whoa, whoa, which way is out? Which way is out into the sunshine? Why? I don't care who else is there, long as they don't claim to be sane. I went to see the guru, he sat me on the floor, and now my body just won't do the things it did before. Whoa, whoa, which way is out? Which way? I went to see my mother to ask her what to do. Oh, Mama smiled, said all the while, there's nothing wrong with you. Whoa, whoa, whoa. True.
long as they don't claim to be sane. Few of us can claim to be sane today. My God, if you read the newspapers or you listen to television, both of which I no longer do and haven't done in a very long time, but that's perhaps the subject for another show. I wrote that song before I became a therapist and before I became a yoga student. So I, you know what they say about be careful what you say. It'll come back to haunt you. But I am glad to have had that perspective, and it does come in handy occasionally. So closing in on the end of yet another show, and I get to thank Josh again. Over and over and over again, if you've listened to the show, you know that I always take an opportunity to thank Josh Hackney, who is my computer guru, my recording IT electronics person of last resort. I record these shows, and I even now edit them, amazingly enough. But Josh comes and makes sure that they're all in working order and everything is where it belongs. And he taught me literally everything I know about this. So this could not happen without him. And as I am fond of saying, if you've got any needs for any of these things, you want to have Josh. He is, as I have said before, both skilled and kind. These are not attributes that always go together. So thank you, Josh. Thank you, Keith. Thank you to you, if you've been listening. Please go up on my website, click on Contact Me. Somebody told me that they had trouble seeing how to do that, but there is a little, well, in several places it says Contact Me. It's in black, but you can see it if you look. And this is easy for me to say because I'm so dyslexic. I miss these things all the time. But I hope that you can see it if you want to. And that you click on me and say, I love the show, I hate the show, I'd like more of this, less of that, this was good. You know, just kind of whatever you want to say, I'd like to hear it. So as always, I hope that you got something you can use from this show, or something that entertained you, or something that engaged you. Certainly something that makes you want to come back next week. And I will be here, and I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray.
Tune in again next week when I will go back to explaining about camouflage problems and how our unconscious uses problems which we already have, keeps us from solving them, to distract us from a problem we are not yet ready to deal with.
That good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance. thoughts I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flag, no, no. We will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten limper, but I won't